You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, January 15th, 2026, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good afternoon, everyone.
We are just back from our Seattle show. It was a fun weekend. Live events are always good.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. We did three different events in two days.
Less than two.
Basically in 24 hours.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, about there. Yeah, about that.
But those are always good. I enjoy them.
It was great. What a group of people. You know, like George was saying this on Facebook, like just everybody in Seattle was awesome. You know, like it really
great
was
crowds.
A hell of a time. And also, you know, like the shows were, you know, ticket sales were very good and people seemed to be really pleased. Just overall, the energy was fantastic.
Yeah, it was. But Jay, that's not what I want to talk about today.
Yeah, I know what you want to talk
tell
about.
Tell us what your daughter said when she came home from school the other day.
Yeah, my wife and I have been launched into a very interesting and, you know, frustrating predicament, right?
So
the day before we left for Seattle, my daughter gets home from school and I pick her up from the bus. And on the ride back to the house, she says, you know, very with a lot of power in her voice, "Daddy, we didn't go to the moon. The moon landing is not real."
What?
Yeah, so I'm
exactly.
Like,
what?
It's like a nightmare scenario, basically.
The first thing you do is look at the calendar to make sure it's not April 1.
Yeah. The first thing I did was literally say to myself, stay calm.
Yeah.
Don't panic, right?
Because I pieced it together immediately. So I'm like, okay, so, you know, tell me what happened. You know, so she goes into it saying, you know, her science teacher who he ended up telling the entire class, probably all the science classes that he taught that day, that there's lots of reasons why we should be questioning the moon landing. This was his way of, you know, handling it without coming right out and saying it. And then he gave her a laundry list of, you know, moon hoax talking points.
And this is
like, how come the photographs and the video don't have stars in them? And,
oh,
you know, the astronauts couldn't get out of the radiation belt. Like no one has ever gotten past the radiation belt.
Ugh. And by the way, this is not like a high school science teacher who's like trying to get people to think critically.
No, this is not teach the controversy and explain critical thinking. This is, he says it, I guess most of them believed it, if not all of them.
Yeah, because they're in elementary school, right?
Yeah, this is fifth grade.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
It took, you know, so I'm unpacking everything that she's telling me. You know, my wife and I are interviewing her just as it's fresh. We just want to get the information. So then we have a long discussion. Of course, you know, we call up Steve. We're chatting with everyone in the family just like as a point of interest alone. Like, wow, this happened. Can you believe it?
Mm-hmm.
And then we started to dig into like, what should we do about it? And what's the appropriate way to manage the situation? So the first thing that we did was we emailed the teacher and the principal and just said, hey, you know, I talked to Olivia. She got home from school. She gave me, she talked to me about what was taught in class today. And, you know, I understand that, you know, you were talking about the moon landing and how people should be questioning it. And she brought up these particular points that you made in class. I'd like to know why, you know, what was your intent on this instruction? You know, what was the context? Just please explain to me what the deal is, right? Just being as generous as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I got an email back that I completely did not expect.
Okay.
The email was a full admission that he doesn't believe that the moon landings happened. You know, he said it's been proven. People can't go past the radiation belt and survive.
Oh my God, the district is going to have to look into this. This guy's teaching science.
Yeah, we have a meeting with the principal after the show today. My wife and I are going to talk to the principal and we're going to express our deep concern over this, you know, and the principal did write us back in the initial email, you know, trying to frame this the correct way. Like, you know, we take this seriously and we talk to the superintendent and some other people.
I don't think it was good or bad. I think it was just a political
first step.
Response. It was saying, yeah, we'll look into it. We take it seriously kind of.
Yeah, it was
an HR
response.
They didn't just brush it off.
They didn't express outrage.
Well, I wouldn't expect them to express outrage, but I might expect them to brush it off
and
say something about Yeah, middle of the road. Academic freedom or some bullshit. So
yeah, no, it wasn't any of that. Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, we're a long way down the road here from actually knowing what's going to happen, how it's actually going to be handled. Like, you know, I have an expectation that those kids need to be instructed about what happened in that classroom that day.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to be taught the real information. And I guess there needs to be an admission of some kind to them that their teacher was incorrect and giving them false information. And I would expect this. This is what I want. I want that to happen tomorrow. Like, it's already been a week.
Yeah, sooner than later. So, yeah. So, Kara, what I was saying is it can go either way, right? We don't know if they're going to be an ally or a foe in this. It could be they didn't express outrage, but they didn't write it off either. It was middle of the road, non-committal. So it all is going to depend on the conversation today. And it's, you know, given this town, just to say that, it's hard. It could go either way, and we just don't know. So my opinion is we give them every chance, we be charitable, we take it step by step, but we keep escalating it until we get satisfaction. And we
Yeah, and I was going to ask, are you in a position where you would be willing to have some sort of legal intervention if you need to?
Yeah, I don't even want to go there yet. Like, I have to take this as it comes, Kara. Like, I don't want to come out swinging. Like, I want to see what they do. Like, I'm going to give them all the time and opportunity that they need to take this where my wife and I think it ultimately needs to go.
But you also said that you want some sort of correction to the record sooner rather than later.
Well, I want the kids' misinformation in their heads to be corrected because, you know, we all know, like, you know, the roots of pseudoscience, especially if sown early, could be devastating.
Mm-hmm. Of course, but this is their science teacher. They're not going to replace him.
Exactly.
So it's concerning that he has a passion about this.
It is. And it's an insidious problem because, first of all, we don't know what other misinformation has been taught in that class.
Right. That means he's a conspiracy theorist.
What is his teaching material?
Yeah. Like,
it's terrible.
What are the references?
Every time that I, you know, there's a study guide sent home or I'm reading like questions for homework and everything, it is borderline, you know, unreadable.
Incoherent, yeah.
So it's part of a bigger problem.
Oh, it is. There's
totally.
A much bigger problem here, and there's a lot of other information that I can't give at this time.
In a way, that's good because that gives you an entree. It's not a one-off issue.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, but again, like Courtney and I are going to calmly and you know and pleasantly talk to the principal, give them any more information that they want. You know, really express our position just so they understand. You know, this is what I found troubling in my own mind. We live in a world where, like, there are things that are happening that are so unbelievably outrageous that comparatively, this seems like nothing. Like, I could have easily brushed this off when I think about, like, the emotion that I feel for this versus, like, just reading the news today. You know what I mean? I had to remind myself, wait a second, this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really, really bad situation. I hope it's not a systemic problem, but even on this singular thing that took place, there needs to be outraged parents and there needs to be action taken and there needs to be serious, serious consideration to what happened here. Because I want to live in that world. I don't want to live in the world where I'm emotionally tired and have to push away things that stress me out. Like I'm not going to let that happen. I want everyone listening to this to trust me that my wife and I will handle this. We are not going to softball this.
And you have some serious backup, Jay. So
absolutely.
What's funny is we all kind of reacted the same way. It's like, this guy had no idea who was sitting in his class.
Oh. Yeah.
Who was getting himself into.
Yep.
Like, what's the worst possible case scenario for this guy? So, I mean, I do think, just for the show, I want to say specifically that the Van Allen belts argument is an old chestnut, right, in the moon landing.
Oh, that's one of the original ones.
Yeah. Yes, there's a belt of radiation around the Earth, but, you know, the rocket's going pretty damn fast, right? And radiation is all about intensity times time. And the time is very, very tiny, and so you just zip through it quickly, and that's fine.
But what's their argument? Do they think that they would
that humans couldn't survive passing through that radiation?
Limited exposure would destroy them.
Yeah.
What? That's insane.
Of course it is. So
they're also full. They're. I mean, it's not like they didn't think about this. They're shielded.
Or
they're
measurable,
in spacesuits.
Right?
Yeah.
They're also doing things to prevent. And plus, we don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe these guys do have cancers because of this, but they wouldn't die instantly. That's crazy.
Well, I mean, a lot, you know, you list all the astronauts that actually went through it. And a lot of them, you know, they, you know, their lives have ended and they lived full lives. You know, like we would know. We would know if any of them died early from cancer.
Lovell just died in his 90s, you know.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they didn't have cancers.
I know, but the point is, Kara, that, you know, this wasn't like, oh my God, it's so much cancer that they died in the
40s. Exactly. This is not an atom bomb. Like, I don't understand.
It increased their exposure.
Yeah, they increased their exposure.
The astronauts in the ISS have an exposure.
So do airline pilots who make a career out of flying.
Yeah.
And we do what we can do to mitigate it also.
My wife said something that I will never forget. After we read the response email from him, which he did not, by the way, include the principal on, she turns to me and she goes, he doesn't know who he's fucking with.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's true. Because you think about it, like I know alone, me and my wife could handle this, but I have you guys. I could call Bill Nye up if I wanted to. You know what I mean?
Like,
you know, the fact of the matter is, like, I don't feel like this is going to be challenging. I think it's just the order of events. Like, what are they going to do? And we will have a response to everything, particularly if it doesn't go what we deem to be the right way.
And that just goes to reinforce how, unfortunately, now you're going to have to be that much more vigilant and check in on her homework and check in on her readings and with a critical eye. Not that you didn't have a critical eye before, but you need to almost be looking for
things. Oh, we're monitoring it now. Yeah. I mean, we've already been monitoring. Yeah. Like, whenever she has a test, we have to, like, rewrite the study guide for her.
But now your ears are perked up more than
exactly.
ever.
You guys need to hear this. Olivia said, my daughter, she said, Dad, how can I trust anything he tells me?
Do I have to
think about the other teachers too? Like she's questioning. Now, trip on this. She's in there in science class now, having to put everything that's happening through a filter. Now, from a skeptical point of view, I'm glad that she's going to be practicing like frontal lobe stuff here, right?
Yeah, but she's too young from a developmental standpoint.
Exactly.
She can't do it
she's trusting of adults.
No, right. She won't be able to navigate through any of it.
She needs
that's
to be able
sure.
to trust adults, like trusted adults.
So, that's where you in court will be.
My wife and I had to get real with her and basically, you know, map this out. Like, look, you know, some people believe in things that are not true and we have to be careful. You know, there's definitely adults that absolutely know what's going on and can be trusted and our authority. You can trust their intelligence, their expertise and their authority in different things. But, you know, in this instance, my daughter at 10 years old ran into a tricky adult. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like an adult that isn't like doing it the right way. You know, I don't know how else to paint it to her. I didn't want to like, she doesn't understand everything we're talking about.
Of course.
She's feeling uncomfortable because it's like, I can't trust him.
Well, what about, okay, can I ask you a quick question? How does your family and how does your daughter, like in terms of her developmental level, deal with both like God and Jesus and then like Santa Claus? Where's she at with those things?
So the God and Jesus thing, you know, my wife and I have been careful to not demonstrably be like, no. Like we just explain to them, you know, this is what some people think. This is what other people think. You know,
do they know what you believe though?
Yeah, she'll ask, and I'm not going to lie to her. I'll just say, you know, I don't think there's enough evidence to really believe it either way. You know, I openly admit I don't know.
Okay.
But I haven't seen anything to make me think that this is real or you know, any of this stuff is legitimate. Santa Claus, they found out on their own. You know, we didn't really have to do anything. Like my son basically figured it out at a really early age. And bottom line is, like, we're teaching them to be skeptics. We're not telling them, you know, what the truth is as much as we're trying to teach them how to think. You know, again, they're surrounded by skeptics. It's infused into our family culture. And I think she navigated the whole thing really well. But man, I'll tell you, when your kid comes home as a skeptic, when your kid comes home and tells you that the moon landings were fake, you know, boy, was that an exclamation point.
Yeah. So it shows on the part of a science teacher, any teacher, this is a shocking level of credulity and not understanding how science, critical thinking, and logic works and evidence works, right? He thinks it's been proven that we did not go to the moon. He thinks this. That is, you know, incompatible with being a competent science teacher, in my opinion.
100%.
And also, he shows a massive lack of judgment in saying that to a group of fifth graders.
Yeah.
Even if he believed it in his heart of heart, he should have known better not to say that in class, to stick to the curriculum. And so that combination is deadly.
Well, that's why I was asking, is this the curriculum?
No, of course
no,
not.
No, no,
oh,
no.
Okay. We know this for sure.
Well,
we'll definitely find that out.
Well, it's certainly not in the state curriculum, right?
It might be in his curriculum. It might be in his curriculum. That's different.
So, who okays these curriculums?
If that's not how it always works. Way part of an official curriculum at any level, right, then that makes it a much bigger problem.
And actually, in some ways, an easier problem.
I don't think we can discount that.
So far, there's no evidence of that. I'll be shocked if that's the case. Okay. I just think this is this teacher shooting from the hip.
We know it's not in the curriculum, guys. Like, this was inappropriate.
Yeah.
He clearly stepped outside, out of bounds of what he should have been teaching them. And what Steve said is dead on. You know, even if he did have like an opinion like this or a belief like this, like, he should know better than to feed it to a bunch of kids who have absolutely no ability to figure their way out of it.
Yeah, it shows a deep lack of judgment. And like, honestly, I think you can argue that this is a safety issue. Mm-hmm. It's a psychological safety issue at the very least.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have kids, but yeah, I wouldn't want to trust kids in a classroom with somebody who has that blatant of a lack of judgment. Mm-hmm. That's worrisome to me.
Yep. Yeah. I'll leave you guys with one last thought. He has been recently elected to a board of education in Connecticut.
This does not surprise me. I come from Texas.
Yeah, that is a little surprising in Connecticut, which does elevate it because now he is a public official, which makes him fair game.
And he makes decisions about curriculum
at a much higher level. So stay tuned, because this is not going to go away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to some news items.
Skeptics assemble.
Let's do it.
I just love the idea. This local Jamoke thinking he can get away with this. And he's got a ringer sitting in his class that's going to just whip up a shitstorm. He has no idea what is coming his way. All right.
Keep us updated,
Steve.
Okay.
Steve, Olivia will go to school one day with a bunch of robes and blue eyes and be like,
oh my gosh,
like the Kwisatz Haderach, and be like,
my father will destroy you.
Oh my God.
Kara, that was about as geeky science fiction as it could possibly get.
I I don't need to understand this.
No, just laugh along. Trust us. It's hilarious.
All right. Have you guys heard all the hubbub from the Consumer Electronics Show about the Donut Labs solid state battery?
Yes. Oh, boy.
I love donuts.
Oh, we got a ton of email about this. This is a big story. Mm. And I wrote about it on my blog, but because I knew I was talking about it today, I've been continuing to do research. Plus, this is why I love writing about topics before I talk about them on the show, because a lot of information comes my way, you know, because of that.
Comments
in the comments and everything. Yeah. All right. So I've done more research, and the story just keeps getting more and more complicated. So let me first just state what the claims are and give a little bit of background. Obviously, we talk about batteries a lot. I'm pretty sure we've talked about solid-state batteries previously. And battery technology is now one of the cornerstone technologies of the, you know, electrification of our civilization and conversion to green energy, et cetera, et cetera. It's massively important. Even incremental improvements can have a massive, you know, downstream effect. Solid-state batteries have been in the works for over a decade. There are multiple big companies like Toyota and others who are putting billions of dollars into R&D to bring these to market. And what they are is they're solid-state in that they do not have a liquid electrolyte. They have a solid electrolyte. That has a couple of advantages. One of the big ones being that they're more stable and they don't tend to catch fire, right? And they should also have a longer charge-discharge life, right, because of that increased stability. But otherwise, in terms of their energy density, that kind of depends on the chemistry of the battery. It's not specific to being solid state. This is the kind of news, like, we've been following this news for a long time. Toyota says they think they'll be coming out with solid state batteries, like commercial, like in production by 2028. And then for EVs, maybe 29 or 30. So that's basically what I had my eye, like, 2030, we might be seeing solid state EV batteries as kind of an estimate. So now this guy comes out, the CEO of of a company called Donut Lab at the CES comes out and says, we're in production today with a solid state battery. So this is at least 2, if not more, years ahead of other competitors. So right there, that's like, okay, you know, let's see if this is legit or not. Not only that, he claims that his solid state battery has a specific energy of 400 watt hours per kilogram. 400.
400.
400. Thank you. Which is, again, it's like the individual claims that he makes are very savvy because they're right in the sweet spot of impressive yet semi-plausible. You know what I mean? So the current lithium ion batteries in production have a energy density of 175 to 250 watt hours per kilogram. The Amprius silicon anode lithium-ion battery has 370 watt-hours per kilogram. So 400 sounds like a plausible but nice incremental improvement,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right, reasonable.
Sweet.
So this is still huge. I mean, 400 is huge, but it's still, it's not like he's claiming 1,000. It's like, all right, this is like ahead of schedule, but that's in what we were expecting from first-gen solid-state batteries. He also said that the battery is stable for 100,000 charge-discharge cycles, which is basically a forever battery. That's a 100-year, multi-million mile.
Oh.
Right, 100,000. That's 100,000.
What are they now?
If you think about 100,000 days, you know.
It's a lot.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
That's talking a long time.
Do you know how long they last now?
You know, in the hundreds.
How many charge cycles?
Right, or
100,000 translates to about 30 years.
Yeah, 30 years, as opposed to, say, 5 to 10 years, maybe. That's a huge improvement. Plus, stable, it only loses 5% of its capacity at minus 30 degrees Celsius and can function up to 100 degrees Celsius. Also, it could operate from 0 to 100%, whereas lithium-ion batteries, you really should be operating that between 20 and 80%.
Yeah.
And you could charge it all the way up in 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
These are all like sort of natural features of a solid-state battery.
Not necessarily.
Right? In it.
No.
Oh, so this is, so we're saying he's invented brand, like some other aspects of new technology.
Yes,
here along
totally. With.
So you should be skeptical already. This is a battery dream at this
point.
But
it gets better. It's cheaper than lithium ion batteries.
All right, now I'm skeptical.
And it's, you can make it any shape you want because it has, they call it like a clay kind of property where you could essentially, like, for example, they show up a drone that's made out of battery, right? Like the structure of the drone itself is the battery.
That's the only way you could deal with the weight.
Well,
right?
it's a huge improvement.
Right? Well, that is an idea that is, we've talked about
that before.
Of course,
structural
right?
batteries.
Where there's, structural batteries are an amazing thing. Can you imagine
buildings will be batteries?
The frame of your house being a battery is like, come, that's just like such
parts
a game
or the frame of your car.
Right now
parts of your car that are
to be so. Structural. Here's the thing: like each one of those claims is not outside of the realm of possibility. The fact that he is claiming to have a battery with all of those properties at the same time makes this a massively extraordinary claim.
Yeah.
And commercially ready.
There's no trade-off. That's the thing. No trade-off. Everything is better. Every single aspect of battery life is better.
Ding, ding, ding,
so,
ding, ding.
So that's a
red... Yeah. Too good to be true.
Almost like he's lying, you know?
Too good to be true.
It sounds too good to be true, right? So then we say, okay, so how did... It's a small Finnish company, right? How did they get to market with a production solid-state battery with all of these features years ahead of massive companies putting billions of dollars into R&D to do the same thing.
That's a fair question.
Well, they must have a huge research team, right?
So you would expect that he has a huge research team. So so here's where the story gets complicated, if it isn't complicated already. So the Donut Lab really is just a marketing company that obtained the technology, right?
Okay.
They have like one engineer on their payroll. Clearly, one engineer did not invent this technology.
Right.
But they got it from another company called Nordic Nano. And
why did that company sell?
Well, it's whatever. I mean, it wasn't so simple. They merged. It's all corporate stuff. It's very complicated. It's not worth getting into. But
it's
not suspicious. It's just there's a number of different companies. You know, it sounds like the technology was mainly developed by Nordic Nano, but they developed... They acquired some pieces from some German company, and now the Donut Labs is really doing the marketing, and there's all the complicated financial relationship. Yeah. But none of that is hinky. That's just the complexity of modern tech industry stuff, right?
It is, except is Donut Labs a startup?
Yeah, these are all startups. Yeah.
Okay.
Even Nordic Nano, I think, was started in 2024.
Yeah, that to me, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but that's why it's hinky to me, because there's no track record
exactly.
with any of these people.
It doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means we don't have a track record to give us confidence.
Yeah. This isn't a Boston Dynamics where we've seen the evolution of their products roll out.
Right. This isn't LG or somebody who's like been working on battery tech for years and has batteries in production and blah, blah, blah. This is just these startups, you know, with complicated entanglements and relationships.
And it's very easy to say, oh, we're ready to roll out.
Well,
but actually rolling
sounds like he's looking
out.
For money.
Well, he is. So, I mean, I don't think there's any question that the announcement at CES was designed to get
investors
in order to build their manufacturing factory, right? That's on face level, that's what it seems like. There are more engineers and people who have, you know, the credentials to work on elements of this battery tech. And the thing is, nobody knows what the hell the battery is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for a
so it's a black box
for a number
right
of
now,
reasons.
Sort of.
So at CES, they didn't have a battery. They had an empty case.
We've seen this before. That,
yeah, this is all Theranos. Like, I'm going to believe it's Theranos until proven
exactly.
otherwise.
Exactly.
Right? I have to go into
battery,
these things.
Who's
that
guy who made the charger, the infinite charger up in, I forgot his name, but same idea.
So I've read now multiple sort of industry level analyses. So from the skeptical point of view, so it's an extraordinary claim, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Is it breaking the laws of physics? No. Is there a plausible path to this technology? Yes. But is it years ahead of schedule? Yes. But here's the thing. The company they have no patents, which is suspicious.
What?
They have
they
published
buy the patents
no white papers and no peer-reviewed articles.
Well, that says
supporting
it all right
the
there.
Technology.
Yeah, that's huge.
So I've read two interpretations of that. So again, everyone seems to be on the same page in terms of like insider industry people. They're like, all right, either these guys are scammers, right? This is all bullshit.
Right.
Or they are going maximal stealth until they are actually in production. And then they'll apply for all the patents and everything.
I have a question.
But then they wouldn't have done this massive CES announcement.
Well, but they're trying to have it both ways. They did the CES announcement to get investors, but if you ask them any questions, they're like, it's proprietary.
Steve, what about this scenario? If you had this, let's say it does work and it's everything, wouldn't you go to someone, for example, like an Elon Musk directly, privately, and say, I've
they
got
have
this,
a, they have a billion-dollar billionaire investor. They do. Yeah.
I'd never go to Musk.
So they have their billionaire.
No,
they
but
have
Musk
a billionaire
has a,
investor.
Musk has an electric car company.
That has already put, I think, a few hundred million or something into the Nordic Nano and these various companies, right?
But
that's
they
what I'm
do
saying.
That
like, there's
anyway.
Like the semi-plausible sort of elements in here. It's like, yeah, they're claiming they're using carbon nanofibers and titanium this, and this could theoretically work and blah, blah, blah. And they're also 3D printing it as sheets, so that could explain why it can be in any form and it's cheaper. And it's kind of all the pieces are semi-plausible. But the thing is, no patents, no white papers, no peer-reviewed publications, no third-party independent testing. Nothing has been tested.
Major.
They didn't even have a battery at CES. So there's massive red flags and reasons to be skeptical here.
They're selling an idea.
And let's not forget, once again, that Rupert Murdoch, Sam Walton, and Bill Gates all invested in Theranos at the beginning.
Right.
And they
Henry
had a
Kissinger and the former secretary, the
Larry
other
Ellison.
Secretary of State, right?
And they had
good
a
points.
Huge contract with like what was it, Walgreens? It was like a
was it Walgreens?
I can't remember, but
CVS?
It was like a it was like a large pharmacy. So,
they claim they're in production for a motorcycle, but it's one of their subsidiaries, right? Or it's Donut Labs is a subsidiary of the motorcycle company that was spun off, whatever. You know, again, it's complicated.
No good.
And like it's,
it's not
owned
Honda.
By his brother, you know. And the other thing is the CEO of Donut Lab 2 years ago claimed to have the first truly sentient AI.
Yeah. So this guy might be operating on a
different level. That guy I don't trust as far as I could throw him. But again,
he just keeps throwing shit at the wall. Is he just the marketing asshole?
Or and you know what I mean? Like, I don't because.
Well, but this whole company feels like a marketing company right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. Well, I think the Donut Lab basically is a marketing company. But the question is the other pieces legit? Like the, and maybe this guy's just taking this technology that other people have, and now he's exaggerating the claims and fake it till you make it, and is premature.
Yeah, it sounds like fake it till you make it.
He's trying to drum up investment by making, you know, by just doing all the marketing hinky stuff. But that
for some reason the billionaire doesn't feel like cornering the entire system here, which it could translate to trillions of dollars.
But that doesn't mean that there isn't some real technology behind it.
No.
But we have no evidence that there is either.
Wake me up when
we see. Exactly. Show me the money or shut up. So
And I think the thing that's so scary with this, with like startup culture in general, living out here in California, I have a lot of friends who either work in different startups or own their own startups. And there's always that sort of on which side of the line are they between like fraud and just this is how the culture of startups is. It's very fake it till you make it. It's very like, oh, we did this one proof of concept thing and now we need to do a round of funding based on vapor.
It's all vaporware. And
it's so scary that it's like perfectly legal. Like it's completely legal until it's not anymore.
Right.
And where's that line?
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. This happened the fourth time I sold the Brooklyn Bridge.
So listen,
look, fake it till you make it has worked for a lot of companies. You know, it's something that does bear fruit every once in a while.
But why is that the model and the standard? Right. Why
I'm not saying it's the right way, Kara, but it's definitely like the way that these things happen.
So no one would be happier than me if this all turns out to be legit. This would be fantastic for the world. You know, absolutely. You know, basically be 3 years or 4 years ahead of schedule with a solid state battery that has a wish list of features. I mean, absolutely sign me up. I'm highly motivated, you know, for this to be real. But at the same time, it's got every single red flag of fraud or of the fake until you make it kind of scam artist thing going on.
And how many times has something with this many red flags ever bared fruit? Probably
zero. The track record of this CEO and of this kind of pattern of behavior is not good. But like we often say with some of these things where it's like, okay, semi-plausible, but, you know, I'm not seeing the meat is we'll know in a few months probably.
Exactly. And I think the important thing here is that, as you mentioned, all of these different things collectively are plausible. Like there's a pathway to them. So they don't have any secret fucking sauce that nobody else has.
Yeah.
Eventually this will be made by a legitimate company.
Right. Except they're claiming they do have some secret sauce, right? That they do have this proprietary technology at the core of it.
Yeah, but I don't buy that we have secret sauce that's like, we have secret physics that nobody else has. You know what I mean?
It's more, I think.
Right, they're not saying anti-gravity.
Exactly. Like, somebody else is going to get there.
They're also clear, by the way, they're also saying no rare earths, no geopolitically significant elements. So
I don't buy it. I don't buy it.
It's just, it's literally a battery wish list. It is a EV battery absolute wish list.
It's like the bad science where you start at the end and then you work backward until you get there.
Or this guy could be asking his engineers, is it theoretically possible that we could do this without rare earth? Yeah, theoretically. Okay, that's it. It's without rare earth.
Mm-hmm. Do we have confirmation that this billionaire really put in money?
This is what I'm reading. This is the industry reports. We don't have confirmation of anything, Evan. It's all super secret. So, it's all like they're doing the trade secret approach rather than the patent everything approach. And so they're not even letting people into their factory. They're not letting people look under the hood. So they're only going to get away with doing that for so long. At some point, they're going to have to put up or shut up.
Okay. What's the game plan here? They probably almost certainly know that there's no way they're going to produce anything like this. So what's their game plan? Get a bunch of investment and run away with it?
I don't think this is Orbo level. I don't think this is like just
Orbo,
fraud, get money and disappear. I don't think that's the plan. I think
that's how you stay in business.
That there's a massive disconnect between engineering and marketing. We have marketing that's just running away with it. And the engineers are like, I think, exactly say we had that now. You know, I'm just saying theoretically we might have that or whatever. I think that's probably
and of itself can be fraud at a certain point. Because that's kind of what was going on at Theranos too.
Or there's a tiny chance that this guy managed to obtain, you know, the output of a lab that really did make a sincere breakthrough with nanotechnology or whatever, with these carbon
nanos. Maybe they got a guy who's...
But I think if that had happened, they would have patented it.
Yeah,
I don't buy this whole trade secrets versus patents thing. Most people have both.
It's suspicious that they don't have a patent yet. At least nothing in the public realm.
Because somebody else can just steal it.
Like getting ready to file. I mean, again, we'll know soon enough, because if they don't have a patent, that means they're about ready to file one.
Gosh, that's normally one of the first things that
exactly,
happens.
Exactly, because you patent an idea before it even works.
Yeah. Right.
Because a patent in and of itself prevents other people from stealing your stuff.
Right. Well, again, they're going the stealth approach, right, rather than the patent approach.
That risk is minimized.
But that's also cover for fraud, right? So that's
how many other things are we using today followed that approach that are in society now? I don't know. None of them.
Everybody patents their ideas. Right. It's just
So it's.
Yeah, I agree with Kara. Like them not patenting.
It's very suspicious.
I don't understand this idea of trying to go stealth. One person in the company with an open mouth can ruin.
That's a two-person company, Jay.
Yeah, but it's easier when the company's tiny.
Well,
yeah,
you're right.
Exactly.
I wasn't thinking of that.
It's a tiny company. Okay. So, yeah, I think there's so many concerning features here. This is really stretching plausibility and credulity.
Oh, I'm looking at their employee list. There's somebody named Dr. Emmett Brown and somebody named Stark.
Whoa. Oh, yeah. And also, why do conferences let people come in
this
and do
this? This is a tech conference. You know, it's not an academic conference.
I guess they don't care. They don't have any...
Well, that's
they
not
don't
their
care
job either, to vet it all. They can't do that.
No, but I mean, do they really want people
you mentioned
selling
that, Evan.
Bogus
it's funny because we go to a lot of science and academic conferences, right? But when you go to an industry, like a tech conference, it's a totally different vibe. It's a lot of big ideas and big showiness and not that much meat often.
Yes, but there are actually products
Yes.
Okay,
But it's sales. It's all about hawking your wares. And in startup culture, sales are not for the product. They're for the funding to keep working on the product.
Right. Sure, for the next, right, and more.
And a piece of the pie later.
We will follow this story. And I'm waiting with bated breath to see which this is going to rapidly, I think, go in one direction or another, and we'll see. And hopefully, we'll be surprised. And there's some meat on these bones, but I'm not holding my breath. All right.
Well, Steve, I'll bet my battery patent that this is BS.
It certainly has all the red flags. All right, Jay, give us an update on Artemis.
All right, so what we have here is the Artemis 2, right? So Artemis 1 was a uncrewed ship that was, it's a rocket, and then there's a capsule that went around the moon. We gathered all the necessary intel that we needed to progress to Artemis 2. Now, Artemis 2 is a crewed mission. They're going to do a lunar flyby. They're going to have something called a free return trajectory, and it's going to take about 10 days to do the entire thing. There's no plan change toward like a lunar orbit insertion or landing. Like that's not happening. We're still functioning analogous to Apollo 8, if you remember the Apollo 8 thing. It's just a flyby. Again, further testing the systems. Now that it's crewed, they'll be checking all of the systems that the crew needs to survive, and scientific equipment they'll be using and everything. All right, so the crew is Reed Wiseman, Victor Glover, Christina Koch, and Jeremy Hansen. Hansen is still the first Canadian assigned to lunar space. The astronauts are still serving dual roles as operators and biomedical research subjects, and there has not been crew changes or any role redefinitions announced, so it's very unlikely, like extremely unlikely, that any changes are going to happen. You guys remember that the heat shield issue was a big problem here. So Artemis 1 had heat shield erosion, and this is still a primary technical driver behind all the delays, which is perfectly reasonable because, of course, we want our astronauts to survive. NASA is saying that the heat shield performed, or the new one that they tested, it's performed within safety margins. The erosion pattern was, they said it's unexpected. I'm not exactly sure what that means. I guess, there were some findings that weren't 100% what they wanted. Artemis 2 does accept the revised risk model rather than a complete redesigned shield. This is not, according to NASA, this isn't really a failure. It's just, they're reframing their approach to the whole thing. Bottom line is they feel confident that everything is going to be okay. And in the end, it's not like a big hardware fix for them. What else is going on in this mission? So the reentry speeds remain the central risk to the astronauts. It's really, you know, that is the point where I think most concern has been put on. Orion is still flying farther than any crewed spacecraft since Apollo, which, you know, again, we're going to be breaking a lot of records here with these Artemis missions. They're saying that communications, life support, navigation, and thermal systems are still being validated under these real-world conditions. No systems have been de-scoped or downgraded, which is fantastic because you'd think that they would be having funding issues, but apparently that's not playing in. The timeline is, you know, they're keeping it at 1 month away, which could mean any time. They're saying early 2026. I heard that it could be as soon as 2 weeks. Again, these are all conditional statements. Nobody really knows except the upper echelon. I think they have a very good idea, but we're not going to find out until they announce the actual date. And again, we don't have a firm launch date right now. The launch windows are extending all the way to April, which means that, you know, they've planned for a bunch of different scenarios. So how does this relate to Artemis 3, right? Artemis 3 is the big, big one. This is where people land on the moon. So Artemis 2 is a gateway mission for Artemis 3. This is absolutely essential before we can even think about launching Artemis 3. Artemis 3 needs, in order for it to happen, it needs an absolute 100% success for Artemis 2. SpaceX Starship human landing system readiness, meaning that whole system has to be 100% developed and tested and ready to go. And they're saying that they're not going to be simplifying Artemis 3 in any way and are not going to try to accelerate the launch date of Artemis 3, right? They're trying to keep things, they want to use all the technology and they want everything to be tested and all that. So they're not really saying anything about like, hey, let's move the dates up or any of that, which I think is perfectly normal. So what should we expect? We should expect a launch, I'd say, within the next 2 to 3 months. I think that we should expect an incredible amount of information coming from NASA about the missions and the astronauts and them talking back and forth to Earth. I don't think we'll find out if anything, quote unquote, bad happens. If it isn't mission critical, I think it's likely we'll hear about most incidents, but I don't think we'll hear everything until they get back and they can do a full analysis or whatever. I feel very good about these missions. I mean, there has been so much, you know, time, attention, money, and rethinking about everything to make sure that this is as safe as it possibly can be. I feel strong, and I'm super excited about the whole thing. I cannot wait to see astronauts leave the planet and go to the moon.
Jay, again. I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
How are these astronauts going to get through the Van Allen belts, man?
Yeah. Well, let's ask your daughter's science teacher.
There is a person in Connecticut, Steve, mm-hmm. that seems to have their thumb on this. We should call them up and have them explain to us in full detail. Like, I want to hear the physics.
I want to see the math equations.
I want to know who Van Allen was. I want to know it all.
But also explain it like we're fifth graders.
Explain it to us like we're fifth
graders. Exactly, Kara.
Kara, that's great.
But guys, you know, when Artemis 1 launched, I said, hey, guys, this is the beginning of like a new era, right? It is.
Yep.
But this is really the big one because this is people. It's not just spacecraft. We are sending people all the way to orbiting the moon or, you know, a flyby of the moon. This is a big deal. When these systems work, we know, hey, we can get people to and from the moon. And that is the game changer.
But my big question, real question, Jay, is what comes after Artemis, right? Because the SLS is not reusable. It's basically a finite program. And when those missions are done, it's done. So isn't the big question what comes after that?
Well, we kind of know, right? I mean, the big brushstroke here was that they make the Gateway platform around the moon. They're going to make some type of encampment on the moon, right? They're not going to call it Space Station Alpha or anything that we want. Or what was it, Moonbase Alpha? That's what we want. They're not going to call it that. They have some other stupid name. But I think the ultimate goal here is to send people to Mars, right? I mean, that still seems to be there. I would have expected defunding to completely total all of this. A year ago, my prediction was, man, we're not going to see any of these things happen. So the fact that it's still happening to me is wonderful. I think we should all revel in it. It's going to be scientific achievement after scientific achievement. And, you know, we're having people, you know, with the insane bravery to put themselves on a rocket to go fly around the moon. And then the next step is the moon.
Yeah. All right. Again, a story that we have to continue to follow, see how it unfolds. But yeah, within a month or so, we could be seeing another rocket actually take people to the moon. That'd be cool.
That is
wow,
amazing.
Wow, man. That's...
Yep. Right? Our lifetime?
Awesome. All right, Kara, I understand that the EPA is tweaking some of their rules.
I know. So we go from one federal agency to another, and I don't know. Even I'm excited for your excitement, Jay, but I can't help but be so skeptical when it comes to anything that the federal government right now is funding. This story is disheartening, and since it was published by the New York Times on January 12th, so we're recording this on the 15th, so 3 days ago, an investigative report was published. Since then, spokespeople from the EPA have fired back, and there's been a lot of complexity. But let's try and get to a bottom of it. So an article that was written, reported and written by Maxine, I think Joselow, maybe Joselow, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name. Sorry about that. Entitled EPA to Stop Considering Lives Saved When Setting Rules on Air Pollution was published. And she references internal EPA documents that were obtained by the New York Times. I'm not going to dig deep into how journalists, you know, source their information and, you know, how they utilize different sources. I will say that the EPA is a very large organization. And even though a lot of people have been fired from the EPA over the last, how long has it been now? 1 year only? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Almost 360 days.
Yeah. Even though a lot of people have been fired and removed from their posts, there are still a fair amount. I have very dear friends working at the EPA who are struggling, you know, with their own politics and feeling muzzled within the organization. So it wouldn't surprise me if there were some leaks and some different documents being shared outside of the organization. So that said, basically, these documents, these internal documents, stated that the EPA's new policy is to stop calculating the gains that are made in health benefits. Okay, so it's kind of backward. It's like a double negative, but it's a, I guess, a single positive. So what the EPA has historically done is they've calculated gains from health benefits that come from curbing pollutants. Specifically, they're talking about PM2.5. We've talked about that before on the show, particulate matter 2.5. So that's anything that's in the air that's 2.5 microns or smaller, that means it's small enough to get into your lungs, and also specifically ozone. So historically, when different industries that produce pollutants have been regulated by the EPA, the amount of benefit to health that is calculated by adding lives or adding years of life has been a part of that calculation in terms of financial regulation. And historically, that number has fluctuated. Like, it was lowest, I think, I was trying to dig a little bit, but in recent years, it was lowest under Bush. It raised up again under Obama. There was even new regulation that was put into place as recently as February 2024, where stronger standards were placed. So this was during the Biden-Harris administration for soot pollution. And all of this is based on like actuarial statistics, right? So anytime you read an article about this, so let's say this EPA press release that was put out in February of 2024, they stated that their new air quality standard at the time was going to be strengthened by moving required levels from 12 micrograms per cubic meter to 9 micrograms per cubic meter. And of course, they calculated there that this would save lives. They said it would prevent up to 4,500 premature deaths and 290,000 lost work days. And then they calculated that that would yield $46 billion in net health benefits by 2032. And so that's based on like, what is the cost of a life? So it's really interesting if you look back at the literature. Like, I found an old article from 2011 where the new cost of the life during that administration went up to $9.1 million. Under, like I mentioned, George W. Bush, it was $6.8 million. In 2008, it was 5 million. So it fluctuates based on politics, but also based on new calculations. So what the EPA is claiming, or not claiming, what the EPA internal documents are saying is that the human life is going to be kind of, they're not saying a human life is worth $0, but they're saying the calculation that we're going to use for our policies and regulatory work is going to be set at $0. And that's down significantly from, you know, 9 million per person. We've talked a little bit in the past about externalized costs, right? Like social costs of carbon, for example, and how that number has fluctuated over the years. Just last year, the White House said that the social cost of carbon was going to be dropped down to zero. But now saying that the cost of a human life, at least when considering air pollution, is $0 is really frightening, because obviously what are the big outcomes of that? Like what happens when you set a human life as $0 when it comes to calculating taxes and regulatory expenses on big businesses like coal plants and oil refineries?
Yeah, well, now you're only going to be considering the economic costs, not the societal costs, yeah. Basically.
Yeah. And so now all of a sudden we're back to a, and we've talked about this, but we're back to a system in place where there are zero externalized costs at all, mm-hmm. right? That just, they're only responsible for the cost of making their product and selling their product, and not for all of the detrimental outcomes of those products. Here's something that's interesting. Since this article was written, and again, it was only 3 days ago as of this recording, The Hill published a new article saying that the EPA denies the reports that it will no longer consider harm to humans. So the EPA administrator, Lee Zeldin, both spoke recently on, I think, X. And also, no, this is mostly on X, wrote that this story is, quote, another dishonest fake news claim courtesy of the New York Times. He also wrote, quote, not only is it the, in all caps, exact opposite of this headline, the actual truth, but the Times is already, in all caps, very well aware that EPA will be considering lives saved when setting pollution limits. And he called it entirely untrue, and he said it was a cute BS headline. But then the spokesperson, or a spokesperson for the EPA, Carolyn Horan, when she was interviewed, I think by the Times, yeah, for comment, this was her statement. EPA, like the agency always has, is still considering the impacts that PM2.5 and ozone emissions have on human health. Not monetizing does not equal not considering or not valuing the human health impact.
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does. So they're claiming, they're trying to have it both ways. They're claiming that they're still considering it. And when you look at an official statement that was put out by the EPA, and I just pulled this, it's called the Economic Impact Analysis for the New Source Performance Standards Review. Economic Impact Analysis for the New Source Performance Standards Review for Stationary Combustion Turbines Final Rule. And this was just published, this month. When you search deep buried in here, the language says, the EPA historically provided point estimates instead of just ranges or only quantifying emissions, which leads the public to believe the agency has a better understanding of the monetized impacts of exposure to PM2.5 and ozone than in reality. Therefore, to rectify this error, the EPA is no longer monetizing benefits from PM2.5 and ozone, but will continue to quantify the emissions until the agency is confident enough in the modeling to properly monetize those impacts. And then they restate that three different ways. So basically, they're trying to have it both ways. They're saying, don't worry, we're monitoring this, but we don't feel like our numbers are good. So instead of continuing to utilize what we think are overblown numbers, read from a political perspective, we're going to remove them altogether until we deem that we can add them back, which I'm not buying.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's in the same sentence, it refutes itself. Again, Carolyn Horan's quote literally says, not monetizing does not equal not considering or not valuing the human health impact. No, that's what the word value means.
Right. Totally. I mean, there's, again, like the common saying, don't tell me your priorities, show me your budget, right? Mm-hmm. What you mm-hmm. put a dollar value on is your priority. It is literally how you value things. And just saying that we value it, even though we're literally saying it has $0 value, is meaningless. That's just politics.
And I think that it wrapped it up better than anything I could read, but Representative Mike Thompson, who represents California's 4th District, put out a statement after the New York Times article was published. And I just want to read it because I think it really summarizes what this means going forward. He said, "The EPA's decision to stop accounting for the lives saved by clean air rules is a dangerous abandonment of its core mission, protecting human health. For decades, well-established science has shown that reducing air pollution prevents asthma attacks, hospitalizations, chronic disease, and premature deaths. Ignoring those benefits while counting only industry costs assigns a value of zero to human life and makes it easier for polluters to do more harm. The EPA exists to protect people and the environment, not to promote corporate profits. Any cost-benefit analysis that excludes human life is dishonest and contrary to decades of precedent. Clean air is not negotiable." And obviously, okay, there's some strong language there and it sounds political, but ultimately the point stands. Why was the EPA even founded? Why do we have an Environmental Protection Agency?
Yeah.
It was established
It's not the corporate profit protection agency.
No.
Right.
It's an agency that stands because we decided collectively as a democracy that we wanted our tax dollars, or at least a portion of them, to go towards clean air and all of the benefits, not just to human life, but across the board that come from protecting our environment. And this is, a huge bastardization. And again, we know that this happens and we know that the priorities shift and it gets weaker and it gets stronger depending on shifts in different political administrations. But like the laundry list of unprecedented things that are happening to science under this administration, this is, pretty beyond the pale. And we haven't seen anything like this at least with the EPA.
Yeah. Again, not surprising, but definitely disheartening.
And will have, measurable impact. Like people, again, it's not a stretch to say people will die.
But even if you take a purely economic perspective, mm-hmm. reducing illness is a huge money saver.
It's an investment.
Yeah, it's an investment. You're reducing direct healthcare costs and lost productivity. So, the programs that reduce harm to health generally pay for themselves.
Oh yeah, they have a huge ROI. The issue is when the stakeholders are the American people or even the citizens of the globe, that argument holds up.
Right.
But when you're concerned about short-term profit for lobbying groups, when you're concerned, when your stakeholders are, corporate stakeholders and not the American people, that's not the ROI they're looking at. Mm-hmm. They want different statistics. What's going to save the, the people who are funding their campaigns the most money? Well, we don't have to worry about health and human safety.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Kara. Mm-hmm. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Quince.
Quince is a company that sells luxury essentials, and they're actually affordable. Kara and I have firsthand knowledge about this. Their products are made from premium material. They come from trusted factories. They have very, very high standards, and I really love this company.
Me too. And so for the holidays this year, I picked up the Mongolian cashmere full zip sweater for my partner, and it was completely affordable. I mean, like a third of the cost that you would get it in a traditional retail store. Absolutely beautiful. And he's been wearing it literally every day since he opened it. He loves it so much. I think it's going to be his new staple for sure.
So refresh your winter wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/SGU for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/SGU. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Bob, this is a story we've gone back and forth on a few times. What are the prospects of life on planets around red dwarf stars?
It's funny you say back and forth, because I wanted to say, in the most recent tennis match of life in the universe is more likely, no, life is less likely, no, it's like back and forth, back and forth. So it's not a surprise. There's a new study suggesting that complex multicellular life like Earth's is less likely in our Milky Way galaxy than we thought, since our most common stars, red dwarfs, basically cannot build up enough oxygen for what's called the great oxygenation event, like happened on Earth.
Yeah.
And was critical for the appearance or evolution of multicellular life. So this is from some study written by some scientists, blah, blah, blah. Okay, first, I'm going to upload the core concepts that you're going to need into your wetware. So they have red dwarf stars. We've mentioned these a few times. These are stars that are the most common stars in all the night skies throughout the Milky Way. 70% of those stars are these red dwarf stars. Our eyes have actually never seen one because they emit mostly infrared light, and they're small and they're dim. So we've never actually seen them with our naked eyes. They also live far longer than our sun. Get this. I didn't quite understand or know this. Trillions of years.
Trillions.
So it's such a slow burn that they just last for ridiculous amounts of time. Our sun is like, what, 10 billion years? So that's really dramatic. Next is this idea of the great oxygenation event. It's also called the great oxidation event, and also some other names. Talked about this a couple of times, so let me refresh your memory. The great oxygenation event, not to be confused with the great meatball event, it's not a discrete event, right? This is something that didn't happen one day. This took literally millions of years to play out, but it did happen around, say, 2.4, 2.5 billion years ago is the estimate, a good reference point for approximately when this happened, when it occurred. Now, this refers to the appearance of lots of free oxygen in our atmosphere. And as you might think, this was quite important. And this was largely due to cyanobacteria, which used this fancy new tool that they invented called photosynthesis. Guys, have you heard of that? So this produced enough of this poisonous byproduct called oxygen to fill the atmosphere with enough of it to literally remake life on Earth from anaerobic to aerobic. And this was very roughly like jet fuel in the atmosphere, allowing the evolution of complex, energy-intensive metabolisms, multicellular life, like us, to evolve. So yeah, this was pretty, pretty important in Earth's history. Now, the time it took for this slow buildup of oxygen, these cyanobacteria just didn't create enough oxygen for this oxygenation event. It was a slow buildup. It's hard to say how long it took to reach critical mass, but estimates put it around 700 million years for this buildup to happen enough. Okay, so that's the down, though. Now we can segue to the actual study itself. So these scientists essentially did a very cool thought experiment. This is fascinating. What if ancient Earth was swapped into a solar system with a red dwarf star? And they likened it to the TRAPPIST-1 star. That solar system is about 40 light years away, basically right in our backyard. But this is a red dwarf star. So if we did that billions of years ago, how would that impact the Earth's great oxygenation event? And also, how would that impact the famous Cambrian explosion that happened about 1.9 billion years later, where the fossil records essentially show a lot of these new multicellular body plans, first time we had seen them in the fossil record. Some of these body plans, of course, just disappeared, never to really be seen again, or for much longer anyway. But also, many of them also set the stage for much of animal body plans for today. So as you know, photosynthesizers on Earth take advantage of our sun's energetic wavelengths of light. We've covered photosynthesis.
Yeah, George plays a photosynthesizer.
Yeah, there you go. Photosynthesizers on an Earth orbiting a red dwarf star, however, would only see about 1% of those energetic wavelengths that our Earth sees, our photosynthesizer sees. So 99% of these wavelengths would be longer and weaker wavelengths of a typical red dwarf star. So they would be, the spectrum would be quite different if you're photosynthesizing on this hypothetical Earth. So what does that mean for these hypothetical microbes on an Earth orbiting this red dwarf? It means that the time it took for the oxygen to build up and create this oxygenation event wouldn't be 700 million years like our Earth, but something, as they calculate, back of the envelope, real quick extrapolation, 63 billion years on this hypothetical Earth. So the huge, a dramatic increase, kind of a ridiculous number. But it just goes to show you how inefficient photosynthesizers on Earth would be dealing with this infrared light. Just take a super long time. The Cambrian explosion of complex life on this hypothetical Earth would take, instead of 1.7 billion years as it took here, to perhaps 172 billion years to happen after the oxygenation event. So clearly a hugely dramatic increase in the time for these huge events to occur on this hypothetical Earth. So I mean, how screwed up is that? But don't worry, guys, it gets better before it gets a lot worse again. So it gets better if you do this. If you add in the really nuanced details about photosynthesis and how it really works, you know, if you include things like photoinhibition and low light adaptation, things that I really don't need to go into detail about, but if you cover those, if you add that to the model, the calculations, the numbers get a lot better. So instead of the ridiculous 63 billion years to reach the buildup of oxygen for the oxygenation event, that goes down to 3 billion years with this new recalculation. So, and also, instead of 172 billion years to reach a Cambrian-like explosion event, it might take something like 7 billion years, around there, give or take literally a few billion years. Still, so the numbers are a lot better, right, with this recalculation, but still it's much, much longer than it took on the Earth. Except when you consider one thing that kind of blows all those numbers out of the water, potentially. Now imagine this photosynthetic life on this hypothetical Earth that don't release oxygen, right? The first ones that we had on our Earth, they're photosynthetic, but they're not really releasing oxygen yet. They would have a huge competitive advantage, almost a game-changing advantage, they think. So not only might they evolve first like they did on the Earth, but in this case, they would have access to a huge range of infrared wavelengths that would give them an immense competitive advantage, right? Because the infrared wavelengths on the Earth now are nothing compared to what a red dwarf would create. So if you evolved on this hypothetical Earth, you would have access, and you can photosynthesize those infrared waves, then you would have a huge advantage because the waves extend, you know, deep into the spectrum. It's a broad range that they could access. That would give them a huge advantage. Potentially, you can't say definitively, of course, but potentially allowing them to dominate most ecological niches and preventing the biosphere potentially from becoming oxygenated. So it essentially just would not even happen. We would more likely, these scientists think, we would very likely have a scenario where you could have, you know, non-oxygen, you know, emitting microbes dominating the planet, and therefore no great oxygenation event, no Cambrian-like explosion, and no complex life. Let me just give you the bottom line after all of my jibber-jabber here. The bottom line, 70% of the stars in our Milky Way do not seem amenable at all to evolving multicellular life that uses oxygen for Earth-type planets. So that's the bottom line. So it's this part of the tennis match, you know, this back down where life is less likely. I find, of course, we all find it very frustrating and discouraging to hear all these detailed studies saying that, yeah, life is less likely than we thought, right? You get kind of bummed out, especially so in this case. This one hurts a little bit extra because it literally impacts many of the stars that dominate our galaxy, these red dwarfs, which are all over the place. So that's like, damn, man, if that's really true, the worst case scenarios are not good. But as we know, got to throw a little, you know, little reality in here to a certain extent. This is a very narrow case, right? This is specific to an Earth-like planet and oxygen-based Earth life, and that's all that we really know. That's the life that we know that fits those categories. There's so much about life and the potential for life that's potentially out there that's very different from the Earth. I'm sure we are just not even scratching the surface of what's possible. So I wouldn't be too discouraged by this. And, you know, I don't know. Steve, what do you think? Were you very discouraged by this, or what's your thoughts?
I was not discouraged by it, but for a reason you're not going to like. That is, I've already written off the red dwarfs, mostly.
Okay, you have. All right.
Because of the issue that early on in the life of red dwarfs, they're extremely
magnetic fields,
variable and chaotic.
Yeah.
And they would likely strip the atmosphere off of any nearby planet, any planet in the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah,
so the only real hope for a terrestrial planet around a red dwarf and a planet with an atmosphere is that either it migrated in from the outer solar system later on in the star's life,
after
or
the
reconstituted
field, yeah,
its atmosphere somehow after it was stripped away. Neither of those are very likely. So I think that chances are, this is just one more knock against them, but chances are, I don't think red dwarfs are going to be a life-friendly star, right? Unless we're talking about life that's only in the oceans and it's only chemosynthetic or whatever. Like, it's just not land-based oxygen-breathing life like we know it.
Yeah, that's a good point, because we have chemosynthetic life on Earth, not based on photosynthesis at all. And they would probably be fine.
Could there be multicellular chemosynthetic life?
That's
a great question.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
I'm gonna write that one down. That's really interesting.
That should go in our book.
So Steve,
or a science fiction.
So Steve, so you're saying like a rocky planet on the outskirts of the Goldilocks zone would still have problems with the active red dwarf star.
I think so. Because the Goldilocks zone is not big because they're not that bright.
Right? Yeah,
it's close in because it's such a small star. Plus, there's the tidally locked problem. It's just they're just bad locations.
Yeah,
for life.
They're not great, and this just makes it even worse. And oh, by the way, these red dwarf stars are about they go up to about 0.6 solar masses, so they never really get that close to a solar mass. And the lightest ones are very light, something like 0.02 solar masses. So they've got a broad range there, but they're tiny. So there we go.
Right.
But still, regardless of any of the things we talked about, I think microbial life is all over this goddamn universe. All over. That's likely.
The universe is crawling with microbes.
But it's less interesting, though, obviously, than multicellular life. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Always.
All right. Thanks, Bob. So, Evan, tell us about the update on the Malaysia Air search. They started that thing back up again?
They did start it up again. It's and I think we're all familiar with this, but just in case, because it is one of the most, well, infamous modern mysteries of aviation, Malaysia Airlines flight MH370, which was a Boeing 777, it carried 239 people, and it vanished, you know, practically, on March 8th, 2014. This was a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Have any of you watched the Netflix documentary on MH370?
Was this the one about the Boeing Max or no?
Was
that Singapore?
Was specifically the Malaysia Airlines flight that disappeared. I think there were five chapters in this miniseries about it. It was pretty well done, but it was, you know, it's a couple years old, and you know, it kind of, you know, left. It's a mystery. So, you know, we don't know what happened. But here are the details. Here's the history in case you don't know. Their last transmission from the plane was about 40 minutes after it took off. The captain's name was Zahir Ahmad Shah, and he signed off with "Good night, Malaysian 370." And this was as the plane had entered Vietnamese airspace. But then it failed to check in with controllers from Vietnam. Shortly thereafter, the plane's transponder was turned off. And when it plane's transponder goes off, that makes it very difficult to track at that point. But military radar picked up the plane, and they said that the flight path suddenly turned back over northern Malaysia and Penang Island, and then out to the Andaman Sea, towards the tip of the Indonesian island of Sumatra. And that's when radar contact was lost entirely. Now, what they're saying also is that after that, a satellite over the Indian Ocean continued to pick up pings from the flight every hour for the next, seven hours after takeoff specifically. And then those signals suggested that the plane took a dramatic turn south into the depths of the Indian Ocean, you know, some of the most remote places on the planet. And that was the last blip of information that we had on it. And almost immediately a massive search got underway, and they were unfortunately not able to find the aircraft. They spent 2 years looking for the aircraft. It could not be found. And then in the preceding years, some 30 pieces of suspected aircraft debris have been collected, And they've been able to confirm that three fragments were from this flight. Serial number or some kind of clearly identifying mark. Three fragments, three pieces of the plane. And that's where we've been. But now the search is starting up again. December 30, 2025, using modern autonomous underwater technology and a refined target zone, the government of Malaysia has approved a renewed deep-sea seabed search for the missing plane. Ocean Infinity is the name of the company that's been contracted for them to do this. They're a marine robotics company. They had previously conducted a search in 2018, but they've refined their equipment. They haven't – I looked online. They have not said how. They've upgraded and improved their technology since then, but I don't know if it's because they're just trying to, you know, keep it from the competitors or whatnot, but who knows. That's what they're claiming. They're claiming they're using their latest, greatest technology to resume a search again. They are not charging – any fees for this resumed search, which is really nice. Only if there is some kind of something deemed to be a success, then they'll send them the bill for the work. But other than that, they're going to be doing this of their own accord to, I guess, you know, in a way, test their new equipment, but also in a hopes that the information they have plus the technology that they have will lead to its finding. It's supposed to be a 55-day mission. So we will have an update on this maybe in a couple months and see what they were able to pick up. It would be enormous news if they were able to make some kind of declaration that they have something confirmed here. And it will be that will be front page news everywhere. Still, because there's so much mystery behind this, not only as to why it disappeared in the first place. You know, I mean, for the most part, most airline disasters are investigated and you're able to investigate them and figure out where they are. But this particular one, they just don't have enough information on it. And do you remember when this was all happening, there were some wild and crazy ideas being floated out there almost immediately, like what happened to this plane? A lot of conspiracy theories,
yeah.
Which is why it sort of has a skeptical angle to it as well. Right. There's one claim that said it landed secretly, was flown to Diego Garcia, which is a U.S. military base island in the Indian Ocean, because there was some sort of technology on board that the United States government wanted to procure or keep safe or keep out of the hands of enemies or what have you. Right. There was also another tale that was spun that it landed and was tied in with another flight, Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, which was shot down over Ukraine in July 2014. And they say, okay, so what happened here is that actual aircraft was not flight MH17. That was the real MH370. And they swapped it out as part of, again, some sort of sinister plot of some kind. And then, of course, you have the extraordinary kinds of claims that are out there, including that might have been swallowed by a black hole.
Mm.
I don't know if anybody remembers that being bantered about. And this was and this was all because of just an innocuous thing that was said on CNN. Don Lemon, remember he used to be with CNN? So Lemon mentioned receiving Twitter messages from viewers suggesting the plane could have been sucked into a black hole, quote, or experienced something like the TV show Lost. And then that, okay, now people's imaginations are totally running away with themselves, and before you know it, all kinds of ideas out there about crazy stuff. Teleportation videos, that was a theory that came actually back to life on TikTok in 2023 due to viral supposedly leaked videos showing three orbs circling the plane before it vanished in a flash of light, as opposed to being some kind of visual effects that somebody just conjured on a computer somewhere, right? So there's all this sort of skeptical ideas and topics that, you know, that we touch on,
mm-hmm.
that are tied into this story as well. And that's normal, in a sense, for a mystery. Of course, you're going to have range of ideas from things that are entirely plausible to outright lunacy and everywhere in between. So we'll know maybe in a few months if this latest search is going to has yielded any new information.
What percentage of the ocean floor has been mapped with high-resolution modern sonar?
Less than 1% would be my guess.
5%?
Very low.
27%.
Oh, Jesus. That's impressive. That's a lot more
than I thought. They've
improved
it since the last time I checked this.
Yeah. So, but that's still a quarter, basically. So we haven't mapped all of it. The Nippon Foundation GEB CO Seabed 2030 project. They plan to map the whole floor by 2030. What percentage of the ocean has been explored through visual exploration with submersibles, whether crude or not crude.
Now, that's probably 2%. Less than 1%. Yeah.
0.001%.
That's wow. probably what I was thinking. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Very almost yeah. nothing, basically. Exactly. Statistically nothing.
So, Steve, why would we explore outer space if we haven't explored our own yeah. planet?
Inner yeah. space.
Our own planet, question. Steve.
So, if that's true, if we do map the rest of the seafloor by 2030, won't we find it by you doing would, that? And also, there. We'll find what's her name's plane?
Oh, Amelia
Earhart. Amelia Earhart's plane, yeah.
Possibly.
What's the resolution,
you would
though?
I think so.
This is with high resolution.
High res.
High res.
That yeah, is, but even the, high the, res, if there's if it's like some, if it's like, you know, under the sea floor or. Or just so it's been so long where you'd have to real, you know, it'd yeah. be hard to spot.
But this is a this is a jumbo. This is a jet
yeah.
from only what? How many years ago was it, Evan?
2014.
2014.
So.
Oh, okay, 10, yeah. 11,
that
12 years
totally
ago.
Totally gettable.
Yeah. So that should, you know, Earhart's plane. I could see you might be a little camouflaged by
yeah.
the processes of the ocean, but
I mean, at least you had unless. An idea, maybe on a flight route where to search for Amelia Earhart's plane. This thing just took off south to the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
And bleh,
yeah.
You know, and in the, I mean, really, that is a difficult area of the planet to search.
Yeah, and Steve, don't forget, big seafloor doesn't want you to find it. You're not going to yeah. find it.
There is that too.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yep.
So I actually planned on talking this week about two recent initiatives by RFK Jr. and in his auspices as the HHS secretary, but I decided I had to cover the Donut Lab solid state battery instead. So I'm just going to refer you to my blog posts on these two topics. RFK put out a new food pyramid, which is not completely nuts, but it's like most nutritional and pseudoscience, it's a mixed bag of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But it is not evidence-based. It is basically whatever RFK thinks is correct. And he also put out new policies that is essentially going to decimate the vaccine schedule, removing several vaccines from the vaccine schedule.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote about both of these on science-based medicine, one this Wednesday, one last Wednesday. So just look for those articles there. The links will also be in the show notes. I just want to, as a big picture, so if all the details will be in those posts, but the big picture is RFK clearly is following a certain process. And that process is, just trust me, bro. The process is he doesn't listen to experts. He doesn't listen to scientific evidence. He doesn't understand scientific evidence or how to interpret it. He is a conspiracy-addled thinker, and he is putting out now these official U.S. policy is whatever conspiracy nonsense he happens to believe in, rather than being a expert-reviewed, science-based policy. That's what we have. And these are just two blatant examples of that. And we should expect more of this. And in fact, you know, if you've been paying attention or reading our articles on science-based medicine, it's pretty clear that RFK is engaging in a relentless plan to completely destroy the vaccine infrastructure in our country, despite what he says, despite mm-hmm. what he's promised, despite what he said when he was interviewed, you know, by the Senate. That is exactly what he is doing. It is blatantly obvious. We have been documenting it for the past year, and he's continuing in that vein. You have to be in denial not to think that he's doing that at this point. He's, you know, not going to outright ban vaccines, but he's doing everything he can short of that.
He's gutting the system that offers the protections
that we have.
Right?
Yeah, he's pulling every lever he can to reduce the number of vaccines that people are getting. Okay, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. That's a pretty crazy sound.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like something spinning up. I know it's not specific, but...
A turbine.
Well, all right. So, you know, this was an unusually light couple of weeks. I think people are still recovering from the holidays, but I did get some fun guesses in here. I have a listener named Burkhalp who said, "Hey, y'all, Burkhalp from Hamburg in Germany here. This week's noisy is surely something spinning again, brought up to a high speed and then suddenly released. I've never heard one in real life, but I'm going to guess It is an electrical clay pigeon thrower. Hope you had better New Year's start than Maduro.
Oh, my gosh.
Does anybody know what an electrical clay pigeon thrower is?
Well, I know what a clay pigeon is.
Yeah. So it's supposed to be one you plug in, right?
I suppose, as opposed to manually pulling a release.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that – it's an arm that like a metal arm mechanism you use to throw up a clay frisbee-like thing that you would use to shoot like with a shotgun or whatever for sport. But yeah, I don't know. I couldn't find one online and certainly couldn't find any sounds of it. So I just don't know. But that was an interesting guess. A frequent flyer here, Michael Blaney, wrote in, "Hi, Jay. Happy New Year." He goes, "Missed the Star Wars sound by less than a hair's breadth, but a miss is a miss." Mm-hmm. He said, "The new one sounds annoyingly familiar. When you reveal it, I'm sure I'll recognize it, but I have to guess something. So I'm guessing it's the isolated engineer noise from the classic 80s Sega game Outrun." Again, I could not find the noise that he's referencing, but I think it's interesting, and I always love video game references.
Yeah.
Another listener named Rich Wrigley wrote in. He says, "Guessing I might be too late, but I think this noise is the sound of the time machine that Albert Einstein makes firing up in the video game Command and Conquer."
More video games.
I have friends that have played that game. I don't remember. I don't think I played it. I don't know. I'm not even sure at this point. But I will take your word for it, but that is not correct. We have not had a correct guess yet. And then the last one I have here is from John Kelly. He said, "It was great to meet you last weekend in Seattle. We'd love it if the SGU made a trip up to Vancouver sometime." If you guys remember, this was the dad who was there with his son.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yep. You must remember him because he was at all of our events.
Yes, I remember. Yeah.
Oh, yes, Max. I think the boy's name is Max.
Yeah, you're correct. Yes. So he continues, "Max wanted to put in a guess for the January 3rd. Who's that noisy? We think it sounds like some sort of turbine or spinning machine. Final guess is a test engine that gets to a certain point and then fails." And he said,
"That's a good guess."
He hopes we had a safe ride home, which we did. So first of all, I'd like to say a couple of things. One, seeing a parent bring a young person with them to an SGU event always gets my attention because, first off, it's just awesome to see a parent spending alone time with their kids. It's important to do that. I think everyone involved benefits greatly from the whole thing. But bringing your son or daughter, doesn't matter, but bringing your child to a skeptic conference or a skeptic meetup or a live podcast recording or whatever, I don't think Max is ever going to forget that weekend.
Nor all the new curse words we taught him.
That's right. Yeah. I know. We have to apologize.
I doubt those were new for Max.
Probably not, but maybe not in the density that we had. Yeah,
true.
We never know.
New and creative ways to use them, for sure.
But Max really seemed to be paying attention and seemed interested. And, you know, I asked them afterwards, and they both said they had a great time. I love to hear that. So anyway, Max, I appreciate the guess. You are incorrect. But let me tell you that most of scientific efforts end up being incorrect. This is on the pathway to finding correct answers. So you're doing the right thing. This week's noisy did not have a winner. And I'll tell you what it is. This is another thing. It's similar to a noisy I had a couple weeks ago, but I couldn't help myself. I think it's one of the coolest sounds I've heard in a while. This is called friction welding. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about it. Let me give you a quick explanation of what it is. So friction welding is when you essentially, like, imagine if you had two metal parts that were being spun up against each other, meaning one spinning one way and one spinning the other way, or one is stationary and the other one is spinning really fast. And that friction actually heats up the metal to the point where both sides, the left and the right or the up and the down, they end up getting red hot, and then they fuse because they liquefy a little bit and they fuse and they stop the spinning right then. So that's what you're hearing in this.
Cool.
There's a couple of interesting noises in here that I'd like to point out. That's them just spinning it up. Right? RPM's going up. What was that? Like some wizard with a lightning bolt?
That's where the DeLorean hit 88 miles an hour and opened the time rift. And
that's where the circuit breaker went.
That's basically the moment that the two things hit the critical temperature and they kind of bond together.
I see.
Yeah, very cool. You know, I guess this is a common thing. I've seen videos of this for, you know, many, many examples of this. I guess it's common. I don't know, you know, again, I really don't know how useful it is in modern manufacturing and everything, but I wouldn't be surprised if this is something that's as broadly used for different purposes. But very cool sound. I'd like to thank Cameron for sending that in. I got a noisy for you guys this week. This noisy happens to be sent in from a person that we know. His name is Ian.
Yeah.
Yep.
I don't know, not a guy.
Not some rando Ian. This is our Ian
of watermelon fame.
Yeah. We'd say his last name, but he has 12 of them.
He won't like. Yeah, that's right. Nobody really knows anything about this guy. He won't like hearing this, but he's an awesome guy, and he does incredible work here at the SGU and has enabled us to do, you know.
He is our tech guru.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Now, to be fair, Ian was the first person that sent it to me, but a lot of people sent this in. So I get it. This probably just dropped on the internet somewhere, and a lot of people identified this as a cool noisy.
They'll be the ones to guess correctly.
Well, I was going to say, if you already knew what this was because you just saw it, do me a favor and just give someone else a chance, because I think it would be – I want to hear the guesses where people are trying to guess what it is. Like, the reach. It's not the actual correct guess that's interesting to me as much as the other guesses of people not knowing what it is. So let's see what the randos out there that don't know what it is, what they think it is. So if you think you heard a cool noisy this week, or you'd like to send in your guess, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, it's a freaking amazing milestone moment right now. Not only did we launch Political Reality, it's a new politics podcast that we launched. Mm-hmm. It's a video podcast. You can also get the audio version of it. You can go to Political Reality. It's youtube.com/politicalreality. We are on all the socials. You can find us. You can go to politicalrealitypodcast.com. That will be a link for you to get to our videos and to the latest audio podcast as well. You should be able to find it in any of your podcast apps out there. If there's one that you use that isn't showing it, you can email us at info@theskepticsguide.org so we can see if we can make it happen. But there is something even bigger than that, Steve.
What is that, Jay?
We are now selling tickets to the Australia conference.
Nauticon Australia?
Yeah, so it's Skepticon number 42 and Nauticon. This is the latest version of Nauticon. It'll be happening in Sydney, Australia. So this conference is going to be happening on this year, 2026. On July 22nd, we will be doing a Skeptical Extravaganza. This is at a separate venue. It's a separate ticketed event. Then on July 23rd, 24th, and 25th, we will have the main conference. The 23rd, we're going to have the boardroom event.
Yeah, it's an event in which we invite you, the attendees, to come and join us to play board games of all kinds with the entire team that's coming down, and who knows, maybe a few special guests. It's a time to, you know, be social, have a good time right around the gaming table, and you're going to be able to choose which games. We'll have more information on that coming up on how we're going to choose the games, but ultimately the attendees will be the ones who pick them.
So that's in the mid to late afternoon. Then at 7 p.m., we will have the conference VIP event, which is going to happen from 7 to 9 p.m. You could buy tickets to that as well. And then at 9 p.m., it's open up to anyone that's attending the conference that has purchased a ticket to the main conference. And that could go as late as you want, pretty much. And then the next morning, the next two mornings and all day, we'll be having our Nauticon conference. It's going to be specific to Sydney, and it's going to be different than the other ones. Maybe a couple of crisscross things, but we're already talking about all the cool things that we want to do. We have a ton of ideas, as usual. George Robb, Brian Wecht, and Andrea Jones-Roy will be joining us. And if you didn't know, Andrea is Steve's co-host on the Political Reality podcast. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fun happening. We really hope that you can join us. Oh, yeah. Don't let me forget. First of all, you can go to you're going to go to nauticoncon.com. Okay. If you're in the U.S., you can go to nauticoncon.com. Or basically anywhere, but I would expect people who are already familiar with the website, you can go there. We'll link you over to the Australian Skeptics website. Or if you're in Australia, I'm sure you already know the website. Just go to the Australian Skeptics website to see all the information and the ticket purchasing. If you have any problems whatsoever purchasing tickets, just email us at info@theskepticsguide.org. We'll help you out with that. I'm sure that some people will run into a couple of hiccups here and there. And there's one last thing, Steve. I hear on the rumor mill that Dr. Carl is going to be there with us for the conference.
Nice.
Whoa. So,
Carl's awesome.
Dr. Carl.
I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. I mean, we've talked to him. He said yes. But you know, the people like him are, you know, they're busy and things come up or whatever, but like he's confirmed that he's going to do it. And we are going to reach out to him to see if he wants to get involved with any of our other events. Oh, and I forgot, Steve, we're also doing a live SGU podcast recording that'll be happening 1 hour on Friday and 1 hour on Saturday. These are other options that you could pick, all these different ticketing options. But most importantly, you could just buy the tickets to the main conference and you'll see us do everything that you want. The New Zealand conference is in play right now, too, guys. I'm talking to the main contact out in New Zealand. We are not 100% done with the planning on that, but it's going to happen very soon. I'm hoping within the next, you know, couple of weeks that we're going to be able to give you the link and everything to buy tickets to that as well. This is all happening. Keep your ears perked. We will give you more information as it comes in.
Okay. Thank you, Jay. Guys, we're going to do one quick email. This one comes from Vanessa, who writes, "I've been listening to you guys for many years, and now I have published a paper that you might find interesting. Hope you enjoy, particularly Steve, since I know he loves birds." Then she gives a link to the paper, including the open access. Here's, I'll just give you the upshot of the paper. It's a study of memory, right? And they're comparing the ability of people to remember associations of bird names and other words, right? And they're comparing birders to non-birders. So what do you think the effect of being a birder has on your ability to remember bird names?
It increases
a very
it.
Large positive yeah. effect.
Well, it's got to be pretty
significant.
Impressive.
All right. That was completely expected, right? And that is not surprising, of course. But what's interesting is the mechanism is how does being a birder help you improve your memory for novel bird word pairs in working memory.
Mechanism.
Yeah, what would be the mechanism? It's not necessarily intuitive. That's why it's interesting. So what they find is that, so you might think that, oh, they're familiar with these words, therefore working memory will take up these words more easily because of familiarity. But what they found was that working memory is outsourcing the task to long-term memory. Does that make sense? So,
okay.
Right. So, if you already know the word blue-footed booby or whatever, some bird name, and it's
that's
in your,
what you
it's
make
in,
up,
that, it's in your,
no, that's a real
you said blue.
It's in your long-term memory. When you have a short-term, like a working memory task involving a word that's already in your long-term memory, you can outsource or offload.
Oh, and increase your short-term memory.
The cognitive load to your long-term memory, so it decreases the demand on your working memory, which is, you know, as a neuroscientist, like that makes perfect sense because working memory is finite and task-limiting.
Yeah, right? Wouldn't it be how anybody who has expertise in anything is able to operate at a higher sort of working level?
Well, again, there was two hypotheses here. You know, it could have been that it was helping working memory itself, but in this case, it's literally offloading it to your long term memory. Mm-hmm. But yeah, yes, in retrospect, it all makes sense, right?
Yeah.
I think we've mentioned many times on the show, and we've personally observed that the more you know, the easier it is to know more stuff, to remember things. There's more things you're associating it with. So this is just providing one specific neuroanatomical sort of correlate for exactly how that's happening.
Yeah, because not only are you associating it and linking it to other things, but you're then able to see what's novel or differentiated from that background kind of knowledge.
Right. Okay, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There's a theme this week. It's one of the themes I've gone to in January, many times before. It is interesting animals that were discovered in 2025. Okay?
Okay.
And of course, one of these is not either completely made up or there is something incorrect about it.
Or it's not interesting.
Okay, no, they're all interesting either way.
Okay. Right.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Scientists have discovered a death ball sponge, Chondrocladia, and then it says SPNOV, which stands for Species Nova. So it's like a placeholder for this is a new species, which, unlike most sponges, which are filter feeders, is predatory, feeding mostly on small crustaceans. Item number two, scientists have discovered a new species of box jellyfish, Tripedalia mypoensis, with 24 eyes, which are capable of forming low-resolution 360-degree images. And item number three, researchers discovered an entirely gynomorphic species of spider in Thailand, Demarcus inazuma, which is half orange, the female side, and half blue, the male side. Evan, go first.
Death ball sponge. What a great name. It sounds like a cartoon character from Metalocalypse, right?
Yeah.
Something like that, right? So this particular sponge is predatory, and it feeds mostly on small crustaceans. Yes, these characteristics make it stand apart. Maybe that's why it was only recently discovered, because they were thinking sponges, you know, don't usually do this. And, you know, when we're looking for sponges or at sponges and things, we don't expect that kind of behavior. And if something else is happening, maybe don't even think it's a sponge to begin with, something else. So, yeah, maybe because of those features, that's why it was only recently discovered. And then the second one, about the jellyfish, which I will not repeat the name, its official name. 24 eyes capable of forming a low resolution 360 degree images. Interesting. 360 degrees, doesn't 24 divide equally into 360? Is that how many times is that? Yeah. So that's almost too perfect. Maybe it had like a number of eyes that were not divisible exactly by 360. I don't know. It sounds engineered, therefore not right to me. The last one, about the spider in Thailand, half orange, half blue, and the color represent. Yeah, I guess color could represent male versus female. There are other examples of that among species, but gynomorphic, right? I mean, you know, cardinals, right? The red cardinals are the males, and the brown ones are the, you know, the more dull-colored ones are the females. So maybe that one is okay. All right, I'll stick with my idea. I think the 24 eyes for a jellyfish is going to be the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right, so the idea of a gynomorphic spider is just too cool to... I mean, I love spiders. So I'm just going to have to say, yeah, that's just too cool to say it's fiction, although I haven't read or seen anything about it. I'm going to have to say that this predatory sponge, death ball, it's just almost too awesome, too cool for school.
Sorry, the name is.
And it just seems to me that if you're a filter feeder, it's too much to ask that there's a species within there that is not and just as actively will be, you know, hunt and kill. But I just love this death ball idea, but I'm going to have to say that is fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Oh, I feel like these could all be science and they could all be fiction. So I'm trying to identify the thing about them that would be what makes it a fiction. So the death ball sponge, maybe that's a thing. And the new species of box jellyfish, Tripedalia mypoensis, sure. And then finally, the gynomorphic spider, Demarcus inazuma. So my guess is that these are all, that you didn't just make anything up out of whole cloth, that these are all newly discovered species. And then there's something specific about them, which is the fiction. So either that the sponge is not really a filter feeder, but is predatory. So I guess it's too late, but the distinction here would be that it somehow has a mechanism to actively catch things.
Yeah.
Okay. And then 24 eyes, that's probably the one there, right? Capable of forming low resolution 360 degree images. So you're saying a single image is 360 degrees, or
not
like
necessarily,
they can see? Okay,
just
yeah,
that
they can
it's able
see
to
in
form
all
images in 360 degrees.
Yeah, cool,
but
cool.
Yeah, it's not necessarily one image, whatever.
Right.
That means,
so,
you know.
So jellyfish, I think, are usually. And actually, aren't they jellies, not jellyfish?
Yeah,
everybody
I know.
Needs to get mad at me.
Yeah, geez, I should have picked that up.
Yeah,
you,
I don't
you
think
are
that's
correct,
really.
but
oh, shoot. So that was automatically the fiction.
It's still so widely used.
Yeah, it's
used
colloquial.
That I used it.
But well, I'm offended.
If I'm wrong, I'll put an asterisk next to this one.
I think they have radial symmetry. So if they did have 24 eyes, my guess would be that they would be all the way around. So then it probably would give them 360-degree images. I don't know much about eyes and jellyfish, if jellyfish even have eyes or if they have eye spots. So I'm not sure about that. And then...
there's no eyes in jellyfish. Oh, there's one eye in jellyfish.
Hi-oh. and then the species of spider in Thailand. So I think I've seen this before in other creatures, but I think it's pretty rare, where there's almost like a line drawn down the animal. And one side has the features of the sort of... male sex within that species, and the other side has the features of the female sex. So they're sort of like intersex. I think the jellyfish is science. And so I'm kind of torn between what does it mean to be a predatory sponge? Like, do they have little like grabbers? I don't buy that. I think they're probably still filter feeders, but maybe they just feed on bigger things. And then the half orange, half blue female male, that one is also bothering me because maybe it's just that they found like a like an intersex spider that
ooh
has sort of all the different forms of genitalia or of reproduction, but it's not so overt. I don't know. I think it's
so you're saying there's two fictions, Kara.
No, I got to pick one. So I think it's going to be the sponge. I think maybe the sponge is just a sponge, but it like preys on crustaceans. But
that's
still
what Freud said. Sometimes feeding a sponge is just
yeah,
a sponge.
Exactly.
Especially when it's smoking a cigar.
Okay, and Jay.
Yeah, okay, I'll start with the spider. So, I mean, a blue and an orange spider. Steve, weren't you and I just talking about the common science fiction colors that happen to be blue and orange? And I can't help but think like, damn, did Steve use those two colors? Because we talked about it. But I'm going to fully... use my, the fact that Bob, who is the spider guy in my life, and the homunculus of Bob in my head is saying, you know, he accepts this. Bob actually said it. So the two of them together, I think that one is science. Mm-hmm. The second one here about the jellyfish, you know, I mean, 24 eyes, it sounds weird, but how weird is it? You know, like it's sure, the 360 degree vision seems like, you know, perfectly cromulent concept. It would be so helpful, particularly in the environment that they live in. Weird, but doesn't push me over the edge. Now, the sponge, which is called a death ball, that like is a killer, you know, just on the prowl, looking to kill whatever it can get its little, I don't know, things on. I don't know. I just don't think it. I don't think that's for real. Although death ball is a pretty badass name for a sea creature, you know, I just don't see it. I don't think that sponges can be predators. There it is. That's the fiction.
Okay, so Kara and Jay and
Bob.
Bob went with the death ball.
Yes.
Right. And Evan went with the jelly.
Yes.
Okay, so you all agree with the third one. So we'll start there. Researchers discovered an entirely gynomorphic species of spider in Thailand, Demarcus inazuma, which is half orange, the female side, and half blue, the male side. You all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Oh, holy crow!
Wow. What is it?
No. It's sweet.
So
wow.
They found an individual spider
who
was gynomorphic of this species, and it happened to be, this is the weird thing, the first specimen of this species they discovered. And it was a super rare gynomorphic individual.
It's like finding the first, what, lobster and it's a blue lobster?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly like that.
It makes you wonder how often that happens in, like, that the type specimen historically. Like,
right.
Especially with things that we only have one of.
Yes. Well, famously, the first Neanderthal had crippling arthritis, and that's why they thought they were hunchbacks.
so this happens.
Does anybody recognize the name Inazuma?
Inazuma.
It reminds me of a song.
Inazuma.
No, I don't.
No.
Why? Say it.
It comes,
did you make it up?
No, I didn't make it up. It comes right. from a show called One Piece.
Oh, I know One Piece.
Yeah, and a character that changes sex from male to female.
Steve, so let me ask you a quick question. Yeah. The spider, is it legit really blue and orange? Or
yes,
are they stretching
look at the
colors?
Picture. It's cool. It's, and Kara's correct. It's a line straight down the middle from front to back.
Oh, really?
And it's orange on one side, blue on the other. And
they fight the ones that are blue on the other side. And
so, Steve, if this, exactly. spider, nice. If this spider bit you, nice. You would become a trans superhero, right?
Oh, I guess so. So it is. It's not just blue and orange. It's like female on the left side and male on the right side, including different sizes of limbs and stuff like that.
What
so,
the hell? Oh my god!
That's very.
It
cool.
happens. It's a.
Can it carry 94 pounds of something?
No.
We're going to get back to that. Trust me.
So it's an amazing specimen. They must have freaked out when they found it. But what happens to also be a new species, but
that's
the species
incredible.
Is not gynomorphic.
Okay.
Well, how common? I wonder if it's, you know, since it's the first species of it that they found and it was this anomalous thing, maybe, you know, a surprising percentage, like 2% or 5% are like this. Or
maybe
10%.
It's more common in this species.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Okay, let's go back to number two. Scientists have discovered a new species of box jellyfish, Tripedalia myopoensis, with 24 eyes, which are capable of forming low-resolution 360-degree images. Is science... again, every write-up used jellyfish. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to use jellyfish. But jellies...
We're going to get emails.
Jellies, but we're addressing it. Jellies...
I know.
Most jellies have no eyes. Some have eye spots.
They don't see
okay.
so good.
Yeah,
that's what
Kara's
but the box jellies do have 24 eyes.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
And Evan...
but
they,
their eyes are only on their asses, though.
They exist in four clusters of six. Right?
What do you mean?
So they're
4 and 20.
What do you mean? Four eyes. Clusters of six. What
oh, I thought you meant
used?
That. Oh, I got you. I
the
got you.
Eyes exist in four clusters of six eyes, right?
Okay.
That's why they, the number 24.
Is, and are they symmetrical around the yes. entire
yeah.
creature?
Yes.
Oh, okay. You know, that'll do
yep.
it.
And their eyes. They're, you know, they're full eyes. You know, they're not eye spots.
I was thinking more like every 15 degrees you have an
right,
eye.
Well, yeah.
That just seemed too.
No, they're clustered.
That's how I envisioned
they're
it.
They're clustered.
Okay.
And it is
so those clusters
of the radial
probably act
symmetry
as one eye,
thing.
Steve, right?
Probably, in terms of like how many images they form.
Yeah.
So it probably is, that's why I didn't say, it might not be one image. It may be that it's four different images in different directions. But it is 300, it gives them 360 degree vision. All right, and this means that scientists have discovered a death ball sponge, Chondrocladia species nova,
damn.
Which, unlike most sponges, which are filter feeders, is predatory, feeding mostly on small crustaceans, is also science. And... yeah, this is pretty cool. It has little spicules all over it, Kara, and it uses them to ensnare its prey.
So it's still, it still doesn't move. It just has barbs.
Yeah, it has barbs.
Interesting. Right? Okay.
It has barbs. Exactly. So
I got new respect for SpongeBob.
Now, I looked up. It's not the first predatory sponge. The harp sponge was discovered in 2000. In the early 2000s, also a predatory sponge. So I couldn't say it was the first, but it is. That's why I said most species are filter feeders.
Mm.
I couldn't say all species. Pretty cool. I usually don't get you guys on the critters. This might be the first time. You usually sniff them out.
Because they were all weird, but also all reasonable.
Cool,
and
possible.
Technically, they did all happen, right? The difference was that it's not a whole species.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, an entire gynomorphic species is a stretch.
Yeah, that'd be... Yeah. Yeah. That was
enough, I think, to be a fair fiction.
Yeah.
For sure.
In hindsight.
For
sure. Yeah. True.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
The quote this week was suggested from Brian, a listener from Nova Scotia. There is no such thing as a scientific truth believed by one person and disbelieved by the rest of the scientific community. An idea becomes a truth only when a vast majority of scientists accept it without question. That is, after all, what we mean by the expression scientific contribution, an offering that is accepted, however provisionally, into the common fund of knowledge. And that's a quote from Robert K. Merton. Robert Merton was an American sociologist who is considered a founding father of modern sociology and a major contributor to the subfield of criminology, awarded the National Medal of Science for his contributions to the field, and for having founded the sociology of science.
I like it. I'll tell you why I like that quote.
Yeah.
Because a lot of science deniers, or some people who are just confused, say, like, for example, they'll say that the scientific consensus doesn't matter. What only matters is what's true. It's what the evidence shows.
Oh, God.
And it's like, yeah, but we don't know what's true. We only know the scientific consensus. In other words, unless you are an expert yourself to such a degree that you can plausibly contradict the consensus of all the other experts or many of the other experts, which is almost nobody. And for those people who are that level of an expert, it's only in one thing and not for everything else, right? So for most people, for most things, all we really have is the scientific consensus, meaning what, you know, the what comes out when you have a transparent evaluation of the evidence and the logic and everything by people who know what they're talking about, and you sort of work it out. We don't have, as we say, we don't have the teacher's addition to the universe. We can't look up the actual answer that's objectively metaphysically true in the back of the book, right? You all we have is the process. And
yes,
that's
the process,
and,
right.
And the scientific community and the consensus, that's part of the process. So yeah, the idea that the consensus doesn't matter, it's only what's true, you don't know what's true. You can't handle the truth. And so anyway, so this quote I think is spot on. I like it.
Dynamite.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You're welcome, Steve.
Sure,
thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.